those introductions made, we'll now introduce the case, 99-3263, Julie Rabideau versus City of Racine, representing Ms. Rabideau, and at the podium is Attorney Alan D. Eisenberg. Mr. Eisenberg, you may proceed.
Justices, I may it please the court, Mr. Lewis, I would also like to introduce Jennifer Hoffman, who is a law clerk, hopes to be sworn in less than 90 days and will continue with the firm. She assists me throughout the pendency of this case. Well, what the students would like to know, Justices, is who let the dogs out?
This I've case, got a relevant question here, counsel, but just go ahead.
As Mr. Lewis has suggested, his concern is about opening floodgates in litigation. He's concerned that there could be a ruling that would extend to reptiles. Well, when I was on a recent safari, I ran into a snake that was one of his named reptiles, and I looked at the snake, who was about to bite me, and I said, I'm a lawyer, and the snake said, forget it, professional courtesy.
Mr. Eisenberg, as long as we're talking about that, I'm going to restrain myself, but and we're talking about maybe whether this is relevant, but one of the things that came to my attention, is it relevant about what kind of an animal this is in the dog? Now, this was a Rottweiler. Is that any different than a Cocker Spaniel or something else that is not as, quote, menacing? Would this make a difference because of just recent, I won't say, but most of us perceive a Rottweiler or a pit bull perhaps, and perhaps we shouldn't, in a different light than we would perceive some other breed of dog?
With appropriate findings and scientific studies, yes, I would like to remind you that this court, in my judgment, because I believe you can close doors instead of opening floodgates with a proper decision, this court last year decided in the case of the man from Chilton who let out a hybrid wolf malamute, and I don't remember the exact language of the decision, but the finding of the court was based on scientific studies that distinguished between wolf hybrids and other breeds, and you found that they were inherently dangerous, and letting that kind of creature to be at large was, from my perspective, like letting a hand grenade out on the city streets.
Well, are there studies on Rottweilers or pit bulls?
No. They are simply powerful dogs, and like human beings, some have bad tempers, and an overwhelming number does not. And there are no scientific findings except to the size and strength, but not as to temperament.
Now, did you have a trial? Was all this in the small claims?
We were never allowed even a trial, and worst of all, which we've put in our briefs, we were never allowed to replead.
Okay. So what happened was there was this summons and complaint on small claims form, right?
Bare bones.
And then the usual procedure in small claims, but I recognize it will vary from county to county, is that the defendant comes and files an answer. In fact, it says, you have to file a written answer. So it was an answer filed.
No.
No written answer was filed. Okay. So there was a hearing before a court commissioner or a judge?
Judge, summary judgment granted.
Okay. Summary
After we had taken depositions and we wanted to replead.
Okay.
And we still do.
And you still want to replead. Okay. Now let me just divide this up into two parts if I can for the moment. And the first part seems to me, when you look at the small claims complaint, at least you so allege, and there was a dispute and the court ruled against you, that you had a claim for property damage, namely the loss of the dog.
It could have been construed that way.
Okay. And do you want damages for the loss of the dog?
At that point, we would have. And the issue is that brings us to the Supreme Court. We concede that this is not Microsoft. This is a claim by the city that, at best, the dog was worth $200. And the reason we're here today has nothing to do with the money. Nothing.
Okay. But let's just, for the sake of analyzing this as a legal issue that's before the court, you had a dismissal of a complaint. Therefore, one way of looking at this, whether it's a motion to dismiss or summary judgment, is do you state a claim for the loss of property? Because if you did, then query whether you could get dismissed. I mean, you may lose it on the merits, but you had a claim.
We would have, had we been allowed to replead, we would have pled that as a separate cause of action.
Okay.
What we were seeking for, clearly on its face, in part, was not only for the loss of the dog,
and
whether you consider that a loss of a life, whether you consider that analogous to a loss of a human life, we were also seeking redress because Julie Rabideau collapsed into a coma shortly afterward.
Well, what you're seeking here is City of Racine Police Officer Thomas Jacoby shot and killed my dog, Dakota, and caused me to collapse and require medical attention. That's the
bare-bone complaint.
Okay. So it can state maybe two claims of action, two causes of action.
Or more. In small claims court.
What are the causes of action it states?
Well, the loss of a companion allowed in other states.
All right.
And disallowed in Wisconsin because the Court of Appeals said while that claim on our part wasn't frivolous, the state of the law is the dog wasn't a parent, grandparent, sibling, child, which we contend it was and always has been.
All right. Do you think this complaint stands for an intentional infliction of emotional distress? I'm trying to put it into words that we can deal with.
Yes.
Then you can put it into new words.
In the deposition that followed, the police officer testified, which is why we needed the opportunity to replead. He testified that he deliberately shot and killed the dog. As a matter of fact, the dog was going away from him. The dog was in the street at the end of his driveway, and he shot the dog from the back, blew out its heart, and then fired again in the direction of my client. So if we would replead, that was not only the killing of the being, but it was an assault on Rabideau, because he drew a trajectory, which is in the file here, and his description of the trajectory goes right past my client's head.
To use the vernacular, if I wanted to drive Justice Babbitt crazy, and that would be an intentional infliction of emotional distress, I might do any number of things. I don't want to look as if I'm hard-pressed to think about them here and do them, but I mean, suppose he values his car and I smash in a fender. And that really drive him wild. And I'm doing it intentionally, not because I'm interested in the car. I'm interested in inflicting an intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's what that would be. On the other hand, if I accidentally banged into his car, and I didn't know if that is emotional attachment to the car, that would just be a property damage. And if I was negligently inflicting emotional harm, and I knew that he was attached to the car, but I negligently ran into it, that would be negligent infliction of emotional harm. Do you agree with my general statements?
I do.
So where do you...
That is the issue that I came here to argue.
Okay.
That's what I was going to go to next.
Okay. So those are two of them, two potential claims that you set forth. And the other, although you don't want to refer to the dog as property, since some cases do refer to animals as property, whether that's right or wrong, or whether it's new law or old law, that's a potential claim in this complaint, right?
Yes.
Okay, so now we got three potential, right? All right. And then you have another one, is that there was no intent or negligent infliction of harm, but it occurred anyway by this loss. Go ahead.
Okay.
So what are you going to argue?
And here's my argument. My argument is, for the satisfaction of us boomers, Generation X and Generation Y, and the generations that follow, is that we need a statement from an American court that will demand respect for life on the planet. We're all done accepting anthropocentric statements of law. We need anthropocentric, that mankind is God and everything revolves around us. That defies the global view. We are but one being on this planet. We need a statement of respect for life. Plant life, animal life, human life, life. Let there be life. In the 60s,
I don't mean to interrupt, are you? So we're talking about all types of life, so this means that if someone destroys my plant, that I would have intentional infliction of emotional distress for that also?
No.
All right.
Not at all. But I'm starting with a basic concept.
Okay.
And this case only deals with a dog. The anthropocentric concept is something that other courts, including a recent decision out of Vermont, but it was a trial court decision, used the term, and I use it here and now. This case only deals with a dog. Only with a dog. And I feel, and the public record and legislation of this country and state shows a major shift just with dogs. In Wisconsin, just for example, we recently passed 951.095 with the subsection .18. Now, how about this, justices? That statute says that a police dog that's injured in the line of duty is the same as a police official. And it's a Class E felony just to injure a police dog. That goes way beyond animal cruelty, which is what also took place in this case. This goes way beyond it. If a police dog is injured, it's a felony. Somebody's going to the penitentiary. And if that dog is killed under 951.095 in the line of duty, that's a Class D felony.
Counsel.
Judge. Justice.
We're dealing with something different here, very different from a
yes.
felony.
Yes.
We're dealing with emotional distress, the damages that can be collected.
Yes.
And as you well know, being a good lawyer, that the courts have moved very, very slowly in allowing recovery for emotional distress One of the reasons being that it's a very nebulous concept, that it's susceptible to fraud, it's difficult to prove, it's very depends upon the individual involved, etc. And so we have reached, at least with respect to emotional distress in this state and in most others, that when a person is injured, you can only recover if that person is a spouse, a parent, a child, a grandparent, a grandchild, or a sibling. If my best friend is standing next to me, and my best friend is none of those, and that person is severely injured or killed, I would suffer enormous emotional distress. But the law says that I can't recover for that. Now, you want this court to state that a person can recover emotional distress. I'm putting aside the property, the value of the dog, but emotional distress for a dog, and I don't demean that at all. I understand the very strong feelings people can have for any animal. But that's a huge step. Why should we do that in the case of an animal and not in the case of my best friend?
I'm prepared to answer that. Several courts have allowed the cause of action as well for loss of companionship. And if your best friend is killed right in front of you, and then somebody shoots at you, I think that there should be, maybe in the case of the friend, a loss of companionship, if you can establish that as a matter of fact and law to the jury. But the dog companion is different from the human companion. And that is what I came here to answer. I have expected before you advance that Mr. Lewis might, and I'm prepared to distinguish. So let me ask you this. What about the dog who is the seeing eye dog for the blind? Does your friend do that? Is he with you night and day and sleep at your side? What about the hearing ear dog? Can you kill that one without emotional distress or loss of companionship? What about the guide dog that marshals around the disabled? What about the dogs who stand by those with epilepsy and the seizure disorder? The seizure dogs. What about the police dogs who are assigned to a police officer 24 hours a day, sleep with a police officer, protect the police officer, sniff out drugs? We already covered that. What about the working dogs that keep the farmers and sheep and cattle alive and protect and serve? What about the hunting dogs who go with the hunter, serve and protect and help? What about the guard dogs, the millions of women in this country who have guard dogs who protect the single women who live alone and are daily, hourly companions around the clock? What about the companion dogs, the pet therapy dogs that are now, you know, there's a cultural lag in the law. I agree with you when you say that. But times are changing. We now have a new appreciation of dogs that we have never had before in history. We never knew 50 years ago that by putting a dog with a senior citizen in a nursing home, you could prolong the life of that human being because of the relationship. Is your friend going to stay with you around the clock in the nursing home or at your home, be on your lap, be in your bedroom, be in your living room, be in your dining room, in your kitchen? Will your friend do that? No.
But now we have to look at what happened in this case, and I don't think, at least I would not take issue with certainly the sensitivities that we should have toward those examples you gave. In this case, just talking about the recovery for emotional stress and being able to intentional infliction of emotional distress. Under the facts of this case, which I'm sure will be argued by both sides, it was a dog, it was a Rottweiler, it was off its leash and off its property. Now, is that, I don't want to misstate the facts, but that's from what I was able to glean as I read over preparing for this case. It was on somebody else's property. Is that correct so far as what actually happened in this case?
No, and that would be a jury question.
All right, but I'm just...
We don't agree with that at all. Our position, as stated in our briefs and throughout the litigation, is that the dog went over to sniff the other dog.
Well, where was the other dog?
In the street.
So,
the other dog? The other dog was on their lawn.
Right.
Now, there's never been a claim that the killing of the dog was justifiable, and I want to address most importantly, which I consider your most important point, about the fact that the dog was off the leash. First of all, there's never been a claim made that the dog should have been killed because it was a Rottweiler. This is the second time you've mentioned that, so I appreciate the fact that it's a point of concern, but there have been...
No, it's not. It's just that I was trying to differentiate between the size and the different dogs that are out there, and that's all I was stating.
Justice, yeah. I had a great big Afghan, and Kerb Yusso's Pekingese drew 75 stitches in it. So the size of the dog has got nothing to do with it. The little dogs are usually more aggressive than the big dogs. So, and I've known a few big dogs. But let me get to the other issue about the dog being off the leash. The fact that the dog is off the leash could mean a citation for the owner, but there's no precedent that says the mere fact that a dog is off the leash means that anybody can kill it. Yes, dogs stray, cats stray, and children stray. This was a child that strayed. He went to sniff another dog, and the police officer drew his police gun, and he had his police badge, and he executed that dog. And the dog was not on his property. And this was a neighbor, somebody who lived across the street from him. And so I say the fact that the dog was not on the leash at the time doesn't justify the killing, and that's a jury question, and that's something that we're ready, willing, and able to replead.
Mr. Eisenberg, Judge. This action is brought against the city of Racine.
Right.
Was the officer off duty?
Under the case law, the ordinance law, I believe he was at that time off duty, and they've never asserted that as a defense.
How do you connect the city of Racine to this if indeed he was off duty?
They acknowledge that they are liable
for his actions.
They make no distinction that I've ever been made aware of that he was off duty. They're duty bound to, he maintained in the deposition that what he did was a police action. They rely on statutes that say police officers can kill dogs in a way that's different from citizens. So that's never been asserted as a defense. As a matter of fact, my client would love it if she could simply have resolved this by suing the officer personally. That was her preference from the start. And we felt we didn't have a choice. And when we filed our notice of claim for damages, the city did not respond while he was off duty at all. They've never presented that argument. So,
Mr. Eisenberg.
Justice.
You have raised fascinating, somewhat novel claims about emotional distress, but frankly, I think there are other issues in this case about pleading in a small claims action and the response to that as though it was a Microsoft case. And there are very important issues about the frivolous claim and what implications that has for the law. Could you speak to either or both of those?
Well, the Court of Appeals ruled that it wasn't frivolous, which is a big part of, as to what inspired us to come to the Supreme Court, that and the knowledge that other jurisdictions have allowed not just for emotional distress. In other words, we never pled emotional distress. We pled the fact that the police officer killed Dakota and Julie Rabideau wound up in a coma as a result of it. So that's what we pled. We should have been allowed to replead. And if we're allowed by this court or any other to replead, we're going to do it differently.
Counsel?
Justice?
I just want to address the issue of what the Court of Appeals did. As I read the Court of Appeals opinion, it indicates that the city asks that we hold this appeal to be frivolous. We refuse to do so. It's true that much of the plaintiff's appeal is frivolous. The arguments about the loss of property damage, negligent infliction of emotional distress, and the intentional infliction of emotional distress are just as frivolous on appeal as they were in the trial court. But one other argument of Rabideau's is not only frivolous, it's correct, and that is the city's response is without merit. So
I make no argument beyond that. That's
well,
all I
meant. But they seem to only hold that the appeal isn't frivolous. They don't seem to say anything about the trial.
They did not reverse the trial court on frivolousness, but meanwhile, we are here arguing for a good faith change in the law.
Well,
and
do you view if you should lose here that you you have to pay up for the frivolous trial? That's what
well,
we're
there wasn't
really
a trial.
Getting at.
We never got a trial.
Well, proceedings of the small claims court. I stand corrected.
We think that should be reversed. We only pled that the police officer killed the dog and she wound up in the hospital. We never specifically pled, as he found, negligent infliction of emotional distress, and we've contended on appeal ever since that this was, in fact, the intentional infliction of it, and also we argue then as today that there's a cause of action for loss of companionship.
Okay. Two things. One, it's with negligent infliction of emotional distress that the issue comes up about the limited category, not an intentional.
But where is that in the pleading? It's not.
Okay. And so you're saying, aside from intentional infliction of emotional distress, you want a cause of action for loss of companionship?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Okay.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Your red light's on.
You're right.
Time goes fast.
I never got into the good stuff.
Well, you got 5 minutes on return. Attorney William Scott Lewis representing the city of Racine. Mr. Lewis.
Chief Justice Abramson, members of the Supreme Court, good morning. I am Scott Lewis, and I represent the city of Racine. I'm an assistant to the attorney in this matter. First of all, before I forget, I want to respond to a couple of Mr. Eisenberg's comments, and I want to respond right away before I lose track. If you look at page 147 of the respondent's appendix, you will see, in response to Mr. Eisenberg's assertion, that the city never filed an answer in this matter, and that the city never contested whether or not that Officer Jacoby was acting as a police officer. In the third paragraph of the facts, the city, in its pretrial brief, said the city does dispute that Mr. Jacoby was acting in his capacity as a city of Racine police officer at the time of the shooting, parentheses, city's affirmative defense number 7. So I'm absolutely certain that we did file a answer in this matter and that we pleaded a number of affirmative defenses. And we did argue in our briefing to the circuit court that there was a serious issue as to whether or not Thomas Jacoby was a police officer at the time. And then we added, even if arguendo he was acting in his capacity as a police officer, he was privileged under the statutory sections. Now, the reason that we didn't address the matter further in the circuit court, as far as our strategy went, as to whether or not Jacoby was acting as a police officer for the city of Racine or not acting as a police officer, and the facts clearly show that he was off duty at the time he shot the dog, and the two dogs were in or about his property. There may be some dispute as to whether they were on the parkway or on the sidewalk or on his property or slightly off into the street and so forth, but we don't really see that as being germane. Our main contention all along has been that this small claims complaint, which, by the way, there were two small claims complaints filed, one signed by Mr. Eisenberg and one signed by the plaintiff, Julie Rabideau, and we're unclear even as we stand here today who it was that drafted the complaint. This may go to the issue of frivolousness, which we'll be getting into later. But our contention all along is that this cause of action was only for negligent infliction of emotional distress. This is what we argue to the circuit court, and this is what the circuit court expressly found.
Counsel, do you concede that if this is a cause of action for intentional infliction of emotional distress, that there would be no legal impediment, such as the category impediment that you find in the negligent cause of action to proceed with an intentional? Understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand, and if you will bear with me, I will be addressing why this did not state under a factual, did not state a claim under the FAR Alstein factors for intentional infliction of mental distress, and this is what the Court of Appeals found. It was never argued, as far as we know, by the plaintiff at the circuit court level that this was really for intentional infliction of mental distress. This is the first I've heard, by the way, that they're looking for a loss of companionship. This has never been presented in either the circuit court or the Court of Appeals. And as far as we knew, this was not a pleading for loss of property. The whole theory of the case seems all along to have been negligent infliction of emotional distress. The circuit court did not address the loss of property issue because it was never raised.
You may argue with regard to negligent infliction of emotional distress that as the law currently exists, a cause of action cannot be maintained. Whether or not they win or prevail is another thing. We're talking about summary judgment or motion to dismiss here. That a cause of action cannot be maintained because there's no category here that's fulfilled. Category being it's not a spouse, it's not a sibling, it's not a parent or child.
That is correct, Justice Breyer.
Intentional infliction of emotional distress doesn't have that relationship requirement. So I'm not addressing whether or not they would prevail. I want to know whether or not a person in the position of this plaintiff can maintain a cause of action for intentional infliction of emotional distress.
And the answer would be no, and the answer would be there's a difference, as we all know from the Jarn case, between filing an action, the frivolousness and commencement of an action, and frivolous in the maintenance or continuance of an action. And in this case, the city would argue, it's frivolous if you were to argue that this is what we really meant to plead in at ab initio was intentional infliction of mental distress. As the discovery unfolds and as the depositions from the parties are read, we see under the Alstein criteria that you cannot maintain or continue a cause of action for intentional infliction of mental distress. Element number one.
Let me ask.
Yeah.
If this complaint had the four elements of Alstein, and there was a motion to dismiss that, and we're not talking about summary judgment now, I'm not talking about affidavits, but I'm talking about the four elements of Alstein were set forth in the complaint and under the umbrella of, you know, the dog and the words that are used in this complaint. Should that complaint survive a motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action on the face?
You're assuming, Justice Bradley, that there has been no discovery, no affidavits. We just have the pleading of the four elements under Alstein. No, it could not survive a motion to dismiss if the four elements had been properly pled in the small claims complaint. But in this case, they were not.
So let me just clarify that. So in other words, a motion to dismiss would be denied if they set forth the four elements of Alstein together with the language of this complaint.
A motion to dismiss would be denied because, unlike negligence, which is emotional distress, where you have a public policy, we concede that Rabideau's complaint on its face pleads a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress, but there's a difference between a cause in fact and a legal cause. And that's where we get around, that's where we run up into the public policy issues.
If you concede that this complaint sets forth a negligent infliction of emotional distress, I don't see anything about negligence here. I mean, I think that the complaint, if you concede that, I don't know why you don't concede that it sets forth an intentional infliction of emotional distress. Both have elements, and let me advance that few of any of those elements are set forth in this complaint. So why, it seems to me it naturally flows. If you concede that this is sufficient to set forth a negligent infliction of emotional distress, then I don't know why it's not sufficient to set forth an intentional.
Well, I think we had indicated earlier, Justice Bradley, that if it did plead that it would not survive, that it could survive a motion to dismiss without anything other than their pleading. But what we're maintaining here is that once you get into discovery and you discover that the Alstein criteria are not fulfilled,
it can't survive summary judgment.
Right, right.
Well, there's a debate here on the facts. I know your brief in your appendix says no, but they say yes, and where the dog is, what the dog was doing, what the relationships between these two neighbors are, that's probably all in dispute. Do you agree with that?
There are issues in dispute, yes.
Okay.
But we go back to the original thought that this is only a negligent infliction of emotional distress, and because this is a dog, it's not
in the categories. So if this was a carefully pleaded negligent infliction of emotional distress, it probably, on the very face of it, under old law, would not survive. That's your position on negligent infliction.
Under current law, it would not survive because you have pled that the item that was destroyed or the thing that was destroyed is property.
Or the person that was destroyed, if you want to put it in those terms, doesn't fit within the narrow categories that Justice Babbage gave.
To use the example over here of Justice Babbage's best friend or close friend, yes. If you pled that in your complaint,
so you said,
that your
dog is a close personal friend, if you've negligently inflicted injury, a trial court would say, not under present law, dismissed.
That is correct.
If you pled intentional infliction of emotional distress because of the killing of the dog, and you pled all the elements of, it's Bowen, I think, is that the case, then
would you automatically dismiss here? Let's just on the face of the
If you properly pled the elements within Alstein and you properly pled enough facts to flush out the elements in Alstein, no, then you would, it would not be dismissed right away. You would have to undertake some discovery, and then you would have to figure out whether the plaintiff should maintain or continue the cause of action.
I'm concerned, Mr. Lewis, this is a small claims action. Most small claims actions are started by non-attorneys, and yet you seem to be requiring fairly detailed pleading rules. Complaint says, City of Racine Police Officer Thomas Jacoby shot and killed my dog, Dakota. Why isn't that a claim, at least for property?
The Court of Appeals, the Circuit Court did not address it. The Court of Appeals, Judge Brown indicated that the way he construed it and the way the city has construed it is that the way it's worded, and caused me to collapse. Not, it doesn't say anything about property value of the dog or property of the dog. It doesn't say shot and killed my dog and caused me to loot and caused me to collapse and caused me to lose my dog. It says the whole thrust, I might add something here, the original complaint, or the, as you're aware, you have to file a notice of claim against the city. The original notice of claim was for a whopping $250,000. It was later reduced to $4,999. Julie Rabideau deposed that her dog is worth $200. You don't bring a claim for $250,000 based on the loss of a $200 dog. You don't bring a claim for $4,999 based on the loss of the dog. There has to be a lot more to it than that. And we are maintaining all along that because of the way the complaint is worded and the amount of damages sought, that Judge Brown is correct. He did not err in his interpretation of the pleadings, even liberally construed, that this complaint is solely for negligent infliction of emotional distress.
Now, why? Look at his wordings. Why? So you seem to say this, under notice pleading, liberal pleading, sets out a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress. What part of that wording makes you think it's negligent rather than intentional?
Caused me to collapse and require medical attention.
That's cause and that's damage. That's cause and that's injury. What part of the negligence makes you think, or what cause of the conduct, what part makes you think that it was intentional rather than negligent? I mean, it seems to me that you are inserting, you know, here before shot and killed, negligently shot and killed.
Correct.
Well, why don't you just as easily insert intentionally shot and killed?
Racine Police Officer Thomas Jacoby shot and killed my dog and caused me to collapse and require medical attention. Doesn't say Police Officer Jacoby shot and killed my dog with the intent to cause me to collapse and require medical attention. Doesn't say anything in there about that Thomas Jacoby's actions were intended to cause her to collapse. As Judge Brown correctly pointed out, there's a big difference between shooting Rabideau's dog with the intent of shooting Rabideau's dog and shooting Rabideau's dog with the intent of causing emotional harm to Rabideau.
Fair enough. I think that's a good answer. Let me just one more try this, though.
All right.
You're reading in before the word shot and killed, negligently shot and killed.
That's what I'm reading.
Why not, if you're going to read in a word, why don't you just pick a different word? Why don't you put intentional and put intentional before caused? I mean, if you can do one, why can't you do the other?
I suppose we could speculate all along, but I do think it goes back to putting the defendant on enough notice as to what it is that they are defending themselves against. Now, in this case, the plaintiff never, contrary to Mr. Eisenberg's assertions, never asked to replead, never, you know, brought a motion to amend their complaint to make it more definite and certain. They knew, once they got a motion to dismiss, what our objection was.
Isn't a motion to make more definite and certain usually the motion of the defense? In other words, if you saw this, and this was a, I'm not sure what this is. It looks like a negligent infliction of emotional distress. I don't know. Maybe it's property damage. I don't know what it is. And so why didn't you bring a motion advancing?
Well, okay.
Why didn't you bring a motion to make more definite?
The reason we didn't is because in our pretrial briefing, we clearly asserted that this was our reading of the complaint. Now, it follows logically that if they disagreed with our reading of the complaint, then they should have brought the motion. In other words, I don't think I should have to insult opposing counsel's intelligence and say, hey, pal, I don't get it. You got to make this, you know, so we can understand it. If you're saying in response to our motion to dismiss or our pleading that this is not what you meant, well, then just amend the complaint.
Or may I address that? Mr. Eisenberg twice said, we were never allowed to replead. What's your response?
My response is they never asked to replead. The judge never said you can't replead. Judge Turoff of the circuit court never ruled that you can't replead. The plaintiff's attorneys, Mr. Eisenberg and Mr. Lewent, never ever filed any motion to amend, never filed an amended complaint, never suggested to the trial court that they wanted to amend their complaint. Instead, our motion was granted. We brought a motion to compel, which Judge Strohorst took under advisement because of some hanky-panky, which the city views at the deposition, and it's in there, and you can read it. I won't get into that. But before we could ever get a ruling on our motion to compel, the judge took our motion to dismiss due to lack of failure to state a claim based on public policy considerations and dismissed it, and he found it frivolous on his own motion. We never asked for frivolous, and we never asked that the plaintiff's attorney be taxed. But that's what Judge Turhorst did.
Counsel, this morning,
whatever you're demanding. It says money damages, $4,999. You say that this does not state a complaint for, at least for property loss. You seem to infer that if they had said that my dog Dakota with a value of $200, that would have then brought that into a property loss. But I'm asking you, why is it not a liberal reading, a very reasonable reading of this complaint, to say that contained within that money damage demand of $4,999 was $200 for the value of the dog?
I suppose you could argue that, however...
Where on here does she have an opportunity to break down her damages?
Well, she doesn't, but she could have put in her brief statement of dates and facts that... And I want to point out something else. This was not just a pro se complaint. Her attorney filed exactly the same identical complaint, and it was filed in Racine Circuit Court on exactly the same date. So I don't think we can say, well, Ms. Rabideau is pro se, and she didn't know what she was doing, and what she really meant to do was such and such. I think you have to factor in the fact that she was represented by counsel at the time. Counsel had filed a claim against the city for $250,000 about a month or 2 months earlier, prior to this, once we disallowed it. Then, of course, they brought their small claims lawsuit. But I think that Judge Brown was not incorrect, and the city still maintains that you have to plead something in here so that the city knows what they're going up against. And if we were wrong, then they should have amended their complaint. They were under a duty to amend their complaint. They should have, and if the time frame had passed, I'm not sure what the time frame to amend your complaint is in small claims court, but they could have asked us to replead. They never did. They could have petitioned the court to replead. They never did. It seems that all along their idea was that they were going to make the city liable on the hook for a substantial sum of money because of this emotional distress. And I will add one other thing while I think of it. If you read the deposition, Julie Rabideau, contrary to what Mr. Eisenberg has represented to you, did not collapse into a coma. She collapsed. She was taken to the hospital. She was given two types of medicine, and she was sent home. She did not become comatose.
Well, she also claims that these shots were fired within a few feet of her, right in her presence. I mean, if that had been a child or a parent or something like that, I don't think we'd be here debating whether or not she suffered emotional distress.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because then it would have been, you know, the parent... grandparent, sibling, within the purview of Heinke. So,
but what is the measure of damages if a person goes out and deliberately shoots another person's dog?
Are you asking what is the measure of damages for emotional distress?
I'm just asking.
Okay,
Other than the cost of the dog?
No, the law in the state of Wisconsin is that a dog is property, and although I cannot find any case specifically on point in Wisconsin, I point that out in my brief because I don't know that the court has addressed this. The majority view is that it is the replacement value of the dog, the fair market value of the dog. So if I have a dog...
Now, let me state this. If any of these folks have a dog...
Right.
And if I were a bad person...
Right.
I could go and deliberately shoot the dog without cause, and the only monetary damage they could get from that would be... a replacement cost of the dog. Is that right?
That is correct.
Is that a satisfactory rule of law?
I'm not sure if that is satisfactory from an emotional standpoint. It is satisfactory from a legal standpoint. Now, let's distinguish that between deliberately shooting the dog with the sole intent of causing emotional harm to the dog owner. Now, you're all probably somewhat of cinema aficionados here, and the examples I used is the bunny boiling scene from Fatal Attraction. That was a deliberate...
Stand in front of the podium.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry. You are doing the bunny scene.
Yeah, the boiling of the funny scene. Or in The Godfather, Don Corleone's, you know, make him an offer he can't refuse, the horse head in the bed scene. That was kind of a grotesque scene, but there you could argue the first Alstein criteria, that there was an intentional infliction of mental distress. The animal was destroyed solely with the purpose of retaliating or making, causing emotional trauma to the plaintiff. Another example is this Tennessee case, which was cited in, I believe, Mr. Eisenberg's brief, where the veterinarian said that he was going to destroy the dog unless the veterinarian's bills were paid. And the Tennessee court said that under those circumstances, if true, there might be a cause of action for intentional infliction of emotional distress, because the distress was directed toward the pet owners, not toward the pet. And also, it was deliberate. He's going to kill the dog in retaliation for the pet owners not paying his veterinarian bill in full.
Counsel, if you damaged my car, intentionally or not, one, it would be the loss of value of that car. But suppose I had expenses of hiring a cab, renting a car, wouldn't you be liable?
Would I be liable?
They're foreseeable consequential damages.
Possibly I would.
So when we have Mr. Eisenberg saying, you know, there are dogs that that perform various functions for people, like seeing eye dogs, hearing dogs, that may cause somebody, that may cause them a replacement cost. They may have to hire somebody to come in and do all that. It may be a human being, it may be the costs of getting another dog, etc. Don't you think they'd be liable for that? I'm just following up on Justice Cross's measure of damage.
If they killed the seeing eye dog,
They
would have to be liable for the replacement value of the seeing eye dog, but they would not be on the hook for damages for emotional distress.
Okay, what about companionship? Is that something different? Should we recognize that as a new tort of action?
Not
an old tort of action, just not applied in these circumstances.
I don't know that Wisconsin has addressed the issue. I can cite you to the Gluckman versus American Airlines case, which is the case of Floyd, the golden retriever, being killed when he was put in a crate and it was left on the tarmac in Arizona, and when the heat was 140 degrees and he suffered extreme brain damage. And a diversity action was brought in federal court, but they used New York law. There they said there is no intentional infliction of emotional distress, no negligent infliction of emotional distress, no pain and suffering to the dog, and no loss of companionship. So under New York law, at least, the loss of companionship for the dog would not lie. I would suggest to this court that it would probably be the same for loss of companionship for a dog. And I don't have any authority for that, because this was not, as far as I know, developed in the petition for review, and this has never been suggested that there is another cause of action that might be brought in the small claims complaint or a redness falcons complaint, which is loss of companionship. Nor has it been suggested, as in the Floyd case, in the Gluckman versus American Airlines case, that there was a damages for pain and suffering to the dog. But in any event, I don't think any of those causes of action would lie under Wisconsin law.
Well, we have said, of course, but the law develops.
That is true. You are a policy-making court of law.
And we have allowed juries to determine the issue of the amount of emotional distress when it comes to those narrow categories of people. Despite the concern that there could well be a fraudulent claim or whatever, at least with respect to these people, we've said that I suspect that underlying it all was the fact that we believe that there is such an emotional attachment between these people that one can be fairly certain that there was emotional distress caused. Well, in the case where we have a human companion of a companion animal, can we not also be certain that there is a very, very close tie and that the death of that animal is going to cause severe emotional distress, thereby alleviating our concern about possible fraudulent claims being brought and allowing a just stopping point?
I don't think you can. If an example I use is a father who buys a dog for his kid, mm-hmm. and the father is not keen on buying the dog because the dog's got to be walked, the dog's got to be fed, the dog might poop, and so forth. But the kid really wants the dog, so the father buys the dog for the kid. Now, the kid, the dog is a companion animal in the sense that he's a member of the household, and everybody in the household could consider that this be a companion pet. Now, the father in my hypothetical, rather than the kid, witnesses the death or injury to the dog. Now, you've got a potentiality for fraud here, because now the father is going to claim, hey, I really love that dog. When in reality, that's not true. It was the kid that loved the dog. What is the defendant to do? Haven't you now placed an impermissible burden on the defendant to disprove the allegation, the per se basic rule that a companion, that a dog living in a household is per se a companion pet? I don't think you can do that. I think the burden is now going to shift to the defendant to show that the plaintiff is perpetrating a fraud on the court by saying, I really, really love this dog.
But we allow a jury to do that with respect to a child or to a sibling.
But it's for that reason that they are, can I answer the question? My red light just went on. The jury is allowed to examine that in terms of a human being. If you were to say that the jury should be allowed to examine whether or not the companion pet is really loved, then the jury should also be allowed to ask whether your best friend that you saw that was killed, that you claim is your best friend, was really loved by you. Thank you. I appreciate this.
Could I ask, what about punitive damages?
Punitive damages?
Yeah. Even if the damages were only the cost of replacement of the dog, if there were sufficiently outrageous circumstances, could there be punitive damages?
Under current Wisconsin law, for the death of a pet, I don't think so. I think if you had outrageous conduct and it was intentional, you may then have a cause of action for intentional infliction of emotional distress. If it was so outrageous and it caused under the second or third Alstein factor, and under the fourth Alstein factor, it caused the plaintiff to not be able to function in their daily, I forgot exactly what the words of the court are, but be able to function in their daily activities, that such that, you know, it was more than just a small or de minimis amount of emotional distress, but it was a huge amount of emotional distress, I think maybe then you might have substitute punitive. I know that's not exactly responsive to your question, but I have not researched the law on this, and I can't respond to you, but I can say under your circumstances that the Alstein factors being met, you might get intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Eisenberg.
What's the difference whether the pleading is construed to allege intentional infliction of emotional distress or malicious and outrageous destruction of property? I have researched it. If there's an intentional and malicious and outrageous destruction of property, punitive damages will lie.
Did you ask the circuit court to construe this complaint as a claim for the destruction of the dog, for the value of the dog?
We think that's what it pleads.
Did you ask the circuit court to construe the complaint?
No, we didn't. We got dismissed before we had the chance.
But in your response to the motion to dismiss or at the hearing in the circuit court, did you ask that the circuit court construe the complaint that way?
No.
Did you ask the circuit court to give you leave to replead in this case?
No.
Did you ask the circuit court to construe this complaint as stating a loss of companionship theory?
No. But it embraces that.
But you never asked the circuit court to entertain any of those arguments.
Unfortunately, we're here now asking in our pleadings here for that relief, for an opportunity to replead.
But isn't it generally the rule that you're required to do that in the circuit court?
Generally? Yes. Generally? Yes. But we got blindsided and we got dismissed before we had the opportunity.
Did you appear before the judge to make oral argument?
I did not.
Did somebody?
I believe my associate did.
You believe? Don't you know?
Right now I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
Paul Lewent was my associate at the time. He's no longer with the firm. And right now I can't recall. It's my belief that he did appear and make oral argument at the time. Ms. Rabideau would like her day in court. She would like to submit this to a jury. We believe that we have, in a general way, pled these causes of action that you have questioned both of us about. But what I thought was the most important issue that I came here to speak about was that times have changed. And now in the 21st century, I feel that a companion dog is part of the human family. You know, it was 40 years ago when Lyndon Johnson called the White House conference on the family. And people thought that a family meant a mother, a father, and two children. And they left there with 33 definitions of the family. And I say, and I can give, you don't have enough time, I don't have enough time to be heard on how many criteria there are that would demonstrate today the companion dog is part of the human family. And I say, if you kill my child, whether it's a human child or a canine child, you kill my child in my presence, you kill the thing I love, and you should expect when you kill my child right in front of me, per se, you're going to be causing me emotional distress, and then you compound it by shooting at me, you can expect that. I think we need to change that standard. And a dog, a companion dog, is not an inanimate object. I think I'll close on these words. The best friend a man has in the world may turn against him and become the enemy. His son or his daughter that he has reared with loving care may prove ungrateful. Those who are nearest and dearest to us, those whom we trust with our happiness and our good name, may become traitors to their faith. The money that a man has, he may lose. It flies away from him, perhaps, when he needs it most. A man's reputation may be sacrificed in a moment of ill-considered action. The people who are prone to fall on their knees to do us honor when success is with us may be the first to throw the stone of malice when failure settles its cloud upon our heads. The one absolutely unselfish friend that man can have in this selfish world, the one that never deserts him, the one that never proves ungrateful or treacherous, is his dog. A man's dog stands by him in prosperity and in poverty, in health and in sickness. He must sleep on the cold ground where the wintry winds blow and the snow drives fiercely, if only he may be near his master's side. He will kiss the hand that has no food to offer. He will lick the wounds and sores that come in an encounter with the roughness of the world. He guards the sleep of his pauper master as if he were a prince. When all other friends desert, he remains. When riches take wings and reputation falls to pieces, he is as constant in his love as the sun in its journey through the heavens. If fortune drives the master forth an outcast in the world, friendless and homeless, the faithful dog asks no higher privilege than that of accompanying him, to guard him against danger, to fight against his enemies, and when the last scene of all comes, and death takes his master in its embrace, and his body is laid away in the cold ground, no matter if all other friends pursue the way, there by the graveside will the noble dog be found. His head between his paws, his eyes sad, but open, in alert watchfulness, faithful, and true even in death. Thank you.
the record, counsel.
George Graham Best from Saline County, Missouri, was a member of the Confederate Congress during the Civil War from 1879 to 1903. So this was uttered over 100 years ago.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. That concludes our argument on this case. We will...